This is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Kaushik Gopal and...
I'm Don Felker.
Welcome to episode 2.
So how you doing, Kaushik?
I am doing good. Do you know what the most important thing in the internet yesterday was, Don?
Was it llamas?
Yeah, llamas, and it was a dress which people are not sure was golden white or golden blue.
That's right, yes. And my teammates at Point sent me a HipChat message saying, hey, is this anywhere near you? And it was the llamas over here in Arizona. So that's,
Oh my God, did you actually get to see them?
I didn't see it. That's about, I don't know, about 20 minutes away from me. Okay. But yeah, it's in Sun City. It's in the retirement community out here. So I don't know how they got out, but interesting nonetheless. And then I saw the dress thing kind of pop up, which was kind of weird.
Yeah, I mean, I was going through Twitter and it was only colors and colors and dresses and yeah.
Who are you following, Kaushik?
So before we start today, I want to just take a chance to thank our listeners. We've had a very, very good reception for the first episode.
Yeah, I am completely blown away by the response from the podcast. I think when me and you got together to discuss doing a podcast, we were certain that there was some interest out there, but we weren't really sure of the level of interest. And we have now had the podcast out for less than 7 days. Well, technically in 2 hours, it'll be 1 week exactly that we launched. And we're nearing already 2,000 listens. And it's an amazing feeling. We've already been featured on Pocket Cast, which is a Android app and iPhone app for podcasting. And they featured us on the Discovery page. So we're right there in big bold up front. Mm-hmm. And so the response has been phenomenal. And we'd like to continue people sending in suggestions for topics and for feedback. We've had a great set of results come back in from Twitter and from everyone else. And just want to say thank you for everything.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. We are extremely excited and humbled by the response.
One thing that we wanted to do last episode that we didn't really get to do was talk about some sample projects with good tests. The thing is, Kaushik and I had some discussions offline and we determined that we really don't have any good list of projects with tests on them. So if you have, or you've run into, or you are building a project with good tests that's open source or something that everybody can look at, please let us know. We'll post it in the show notes. We'll mention it on the next show. But it'd be really great so we could see a lot of great examples out there so everyone can start building better software.
So in this episode, we are going to talk about Android Studio. As an Android developer, it's a good thing to know the most important tool in your arsenal. Know more like information on who builds your IDE. Do you have access to the source? Is it open source? Is it a paid tool? What if the maintainer decides to suddenly abandon the IDE after you've invested so much time in it? What are some of the tips and tricks that you didn't know existed with Android Studio, the IDE? The more you know about your IDE, the better it is. So basically today we intend to touch on all these questions. Now, discussing IDEs is usually a sort of slippery slope because, I mean, it tends to be almost like an irresistible, unhealthy, but very gratifying sort of topic. So we're going to try and keep this discussion tight and useful.
Yeah, I agree. And if you're like me, all of your IDEs are basically IntelliJ IDEs. I run Android Studio, and prior to Android Studio, I ran IntelliJ with the Android plugin that came with it. And I think that went all the way back to version 9 or version 10. I forget where it came out, but it was very early on. And so as soon as I could abandon Eclipse, I did so. And I've been using IntelliJ products for a long time. I use WebStorm for Node.js and Angular and the web stuff. I use RubyMine for Rails projects, PyCharm for Python. And back in the early 2000s, when I was doing some .NET work, I used the ReSharper plugin for Visual Studio. The thing with Android Studio that really gets me excited is that everyone who has seen me present or seen me talk about the topic knows that I absolutely love IntelliJ and Android Studio because of all the benefits that we're going to talk about today. I am super relieved that we are now migrating. Everyone's usually migrating now to Android Studio because I have a large disdain for Eclipse. And one of those reasons is when I wrote my books, the IDE of choice was Eclipse. And there were so many problems that I would run into with Eclipse. And so I'm just really excited that everything's moving over to Android Studio.
Yeah, Android Studio has been amazing. And IntelliJ, I've used RubyMine. I haven't used the whole gamut of other tools that they have. But there's no question. IntelliJ is clearly like one of the best IDEs out there.
Yeah, completely agree.
So before we start, again, I just want to touch on the importance of your IDE. Basically, from what I know, developers subscribe to either one of the two philosophies. The first is basically people think that all you need is just like a text editor, right? You want a blank, bare bones sort of text editing canvas without any of the extra bells and whistles. They're like, keep it clean. I mean, I have the code in my head. I want to type every single thing out. That's like the first group. The second group is, and I guess most of us subscribe to this, is where they believe that the IDE shouldn't just be a text editing canvas. It should actually help you. It should aid in making you a better sort of programmer and write better code. Because in the end, what you would like to have is a straight conduit from like the ideas that you have in your head, and you want that to be translated into code as easily and as seamlessly as possible. So I guess most of us subscribe to the second sort of philosophy, but it's worth mention. A good IDE can help in many ways. It, besides just being like a pure source editor or code editor, you have things like build tools, you have lint tools that we're definitely going to talk about, then you have a debugger. You can make your life as a developer very, very easy, and it'll also help you get more efficient. One thought that does come to mind is Ben Ornstein of ThoughtBot fame, and he's, again, a prolific speaker and podcaster as well. I remember him saying, when you think about software engineering, you think of it as a craft. Software engineering is a craft, and you, the developer, are considered a sort of craftsman, right? So if you are a craftsman, you want to make sure that the tools that you have are the best tools available, because only then the code that you produce looks as beautiful as other arts and craft.
Completely agree.
So Don, can you like walk us through some of the initial steps?
Yeah, definitely. So I think what we should cover is, you know, what is Android Studio and kind of where it came from, a little background information. So in Google I.O. in 2013, and Google I.O., for those not familiar, is the big developer conference that Google hosts. The tools team over at Google released a new IDE, and that was called Android Studio. And that IDE was specifically for Android development. Now, previously, before we had Android Studio involved, we had Eclipse. And this was kind of the de facto standard for developing Android applications. And it was just basically Eclipse with a plugin for Android development, which was the ADT, the Android Development Tools. And oh boy, was that a joy to work with. I can't tell you how many times I would do a clean and then a build and then a clean, then a build, then a rebuild. And then that wouldn't work. And then I'd restart the IDE. And then, oh, now all of a sudden it magically works. and then you just don't get that 30 minutes back. And so this happened. I can't tell you how many times this happened when I was writing my books or even client projects. You can write code, and then all of a sudden the IDE would just crash, and there would be no save points and so forth. So it was very frustrating for me personally, but that's kind of where we were before. So that's the where Android Studio came from. And so Google worked with JetBrains and so forth to, and JetBrains is a company that helps create Android Studio. Now, kind of go a little more deeper into Android Studio and IntelliJ and JetBrains and so forth. So Android Studio is based upon the popular editor called IntelliJ IDEA. IntelliJ is easily probably one of the best editors out there for Java development, at least in my opinion, and I think Kaushik's as well.
Oh, definitely.
So Android Studio is being based off of that, and it's just simply amazing. Do you want to talk a little bit about the open sourceness of Android Studio, Kaushik?
Yeah, sure. So one common confusion that arises is Android Studio really open source? Because like you said, it's based off IntelliJ IDEA, which is an amazing editor, but it's not that cheap. I mean, it's $200 a pop. I mean, which again, personally, if you ask both me and Don, definitely I think it's worth giving the $200 because it is that amazing an editor. But the source of confusion essentially is like, well, if IntelliJ IDEA is like $200, how is it that Android Studio is free? I mean, does Google pay JetBrains every time someone downloads Android Studio or something? The way it works is, okay, JetBrains is the company that basically builds many of these editors, and IntelliJ IDEA is their flagship editor. What IntelliJ is a platform that allows you to build language-aware IDEs. So you could build language-aware IDEs, and this is basically what Don was mentioning before. They have editors out for Ruby on Rails, for Python, for Node.js. They have amazing editors for all of these languages. And the platform that they use to build these editors is basically called IntelliJ. Now, the platform per se, IntelliJ, the platform, is open source. And I actually checked this again, and it's actually an Apache 2.0 license. So there's no doubt. The IntelliJ platform is open source. Now, just like how they have done for most of these languages, the folks over at Google decided to use the same platform. So they use IntelliJ, the platform, and they build a sort of tailored IDE for Android development. And that exactly is Android Studio. The folks at Google, again, were a little more benevolent, and they decided to make it free and open source. So Android Studio is free. There's absolutely no question. Now, if you had more doubts, we'll add a link to this in the show notes. There's actually a page on the official developer tools site. It's tools.android.com/build/studio. So you can look at the instructions there and actually build Android Studio from command line. So the source code is available. Like, there's absolutely no question. It's open source. You should actually try it over the weekend if none of your TV shows have started. Oh, by the way, House of Cards has started. So this weekend is going to be hard. But if you want some time to kill and you just basically want to understand the editor even better, you can actually go ahead and try building it from source. So have no questions. Android Studio is completely open source.
I also like to bring up the fact that if you do other types of Java development and you want to use IntelliJ, you can still use IntelliJ to develop Android applications. All of the plugins and so forth still work inside of IntelliJ, so you can use either one if you'd like. And furthermore, if you do develop Android or Java open source, you can actually apply to get an open source developer license from JetBrains. Just reach out to JetBrains, go to jetbrains.com, and just go to their contact page and tell them, hey, I'm an open source developer. I was wondering if I could get a open source developer license. And for me, I've written some bunch of open source for a while, and they'll give you a open source ultimate license, which is the full-blown version of IntelliJ IDEA for Java. And it's just, it's great. It has all the bells and whistles built in.
Now, I'm guessing both of us are going to make a pitch to actually ask everyone to use Android Studio, but we should give concrete reasons.
The first main reason that you want to use Android Studio is that's the official editor for Android development. You know, previously this was Eclipse with the plugin called ADT. Again, that's Android Developers Tools. And some people have the opinion that Google's personal motto is probably to confuse the living hell out of everyone with their own naming all over the place, but it is what it is, you know? So we're finally at a 1.0 release. Android Studio, again, what are we, at 1 or 2 years it's been in the making? It's been a while, so 2 years now. Mm-hmm. So the 1.0 release recently came out. They basically said that they're throwing all their weight behind Android Studio, and this is sort of a change in stance because previously they were, they'd come out and say, hey, no, we're still going to support ADT. It's not going anywhere. It's all good. Don't worry. It'll be cool. And this happened when Mike Wolfson and I wrote the Android Developer Tools book, the ADT book. Mm-hmm. This was the stance that they had. And so he was very adamant about, no, ADT is not going anywhere. And he had heard it from Google. And unfortunately, that's kind of not the case anymore. So, but I think it's a positive movement. We're going towards the right direction. So hopefully Google saying this is the right thing to do and us saying that can give you some incentive to try it out. And also, we had some people at the PHX Android user group asking if they could use Eclipse still this week. So I hosted the PHX Android user group a couple of days ago here in Arizona. And I had a couple of folks in the crowd asking, hey, I still want to use Eclipse. I actually found an old version of Eclipse and an old ADT plugin. and I downloaded it and saved it and I installed it. And can I still use Eclipse? I'm very familiar with Eclipse. Mm-hmm. The answer was kind of like, well, if you can get it to run, it might work. There's not really going to be any support out there for it. And they're kind of abandoning it. So you probably should take the time, and as Kaushik said, if you're not binge watching anything this weekend, pull up Android Studio. It's easy to install and check it out.
In all fairness, I understand the sentiment where people don't want to keep switching IDEs, especially because once you get very used to an IDE, even if you're given an alternative option that you believe is better, it just takes so much time to relearn everything. But in this case, it kind of makes sense because, like you said, Google is officially changing their stance. I mean, if you go to the developer tools page today, there is no question. They call Android Studio their official editor.
Yeah, and before they had Eclipse, and with Eclipse they were using, you know, you could use Ant or you could kind of move your project into Maven. Mm-hmm. And with Android Studio, they came out with the new build system called Gradle. Mm-hmm. And I think that we had talked about this before. And if you want to hop in and let everyone know what you're doing with your apps here, with your version numbers and Git hashes and so forth, I think that's very interesting. And maybe you can even talk about Gradle a little bit.
Oh, yeah, sure. So one of the biggest advantages with using Android Studio is right out of the bat, it ships with a build system called Gradle. Now, Gradle is essentially, it is the build system, but it's written actually in another programming language called Groovy. Now, this is really good because, again, Don, you can help me out here if I'm making some mistakes, but Ant or Maven, it's essentially XML-based, so there isn't too much scope to be able to write sort of like code that handles logic in any way. You can't really write code snippets without extra efforts, or it isn't as easy to do that. Am I right there?
Yeah, there's a lot of bracket tax going on there, for sure. There's a lot of bracket tax happening in that. So you can do that. You can execute certain commands, but then you might have to write a plugin for Maven. You kind of have to hop through a lot of hoops with Maven. Now, Maven was definitely an upgrade from Ant, in my opinion, because of the dependency management and all of the project management stuff you get with Maven. But I definitely feel that Gradle is a big improvement because you can actually write Groovy code in your build files to execute commands and do things and build functions and so forth in there, and that's super powerful.
Absolutely. So one common thing that we do right now with our app is because we have so many builds flying around, and like people sometimes are like, if they're able to reproduce a crash or something and they come and tell us, hey, I'm using this version of the app, it's on my phone, it becomes tricky to find the exact build version. So what we do is we actually, and this is pretty common at this point, if you see most projects, they happen to have these scripts. You can write two Groovy functions, that one which basically gives you the build time. So when exactly you made that build, it'll actually store that time in a variable. And the other thing you can do is actually have like a Git hash, like the Git hash that you traditionally see on command line, it would actually append those. So in addition to the version numbers that you typically have with your Android app, you can add these two things, which are more reflective of the exact build version, because you could have multiple builds with the same version. But with your Git hash and the build, the specific build time, there's a much better chance that you can get hold of that specific build in a more accurate manner.
Yeah, and you'll see a lot of this happen on the about pages of applications if they have them, or on a contact page or something like that, or a support page, or I should say screen, actually, support screen. You'll see people have the, or developers will put the Git hash plus the version code. So we did this at, well, we didn't put the Git hash, but at MyFitnessPal we did have like the version number, and that allowed the support department to easily work with the customer and say, hey, show us your exact version. And we incremented version numbers very aggressively, so there was no duplicates lying around. The fact that you can actually add that stuff to your build script is phenomenal. And this is all done, again, inside the build.gradle file. Another cool thing that you can also do is work with build variants. And that's a whole other topic in itself. And I just did a talk on this earlier this week. And what you can do is actually have different runtime and composability built inside of your application with build variants. You can switch out resources. Maybe you can have different icons for different build environments. And what I mean by this is, for example, on my debug builds, I like to take our existing icon and just throw it in Photoshop for a couple of minutes. And I'll just lay like a little red banner across the front of it, or in the corner I'll do something and it'll just say debug. I'll put something on there so I can visually see that this is a debug version. And you have a different folder inside of your SRC folder. You'll have your main, your Android test. You can also put a debug in there or a release one in there. And you can go inside there and create the RES folder, the resource folder. And then you can create resource specific or Java specific files for that build variant environment. And so that allows me to easily install an application for debug. And if we're having a problem, I can say, hey, this is the debug version. Let's make sure this, that's why we're having this one problem, or that's why you're seeing this one weird side effect, or that's why the debug menu is still present. So we have that. Now, there's so many different ways to do this, as well as the Git hash and the build time. And I think a great example project is Jake Wharton's U2020 application. and that's up on GitHub, which we'll put in the show notes. It shows how to use Dagger to build a big, basically a composable app so you can have a different environment. There's actually a debug panel that swipes out from the right-hand side that you can actually do different view options and use Scalpel. You can also slow down like network and work with Picasso a little bit differently, which are a couple other libraries. Anyway, it's a great example, and we'll link that in the show notes as well.
Oh, yeah, the U2020 app is amazing. In the last show, we talked about finding example projects. So the Google I/O project obviously is one that I look at, and Jake's U2020 project is another one that I always keep an eye on, because these are both very high quality apps written. So it makes sense to go and sort of try to learn from these repositories. Okay, so I guess now we should get into the fun part and talk about some of the tips and tricks that we have gathered with Android Studio. But before that, we've talked about this offline, so we probably have slightly different philosophies towards this, but
yeah,
let's talk about it. So I basically customized the heck out of Android Studio. So like, I've changed every single aspect of it, like the color, the theme. What about you, Don?
I tend to keep it just pretty simple. And the reason for that is I want to be able to, again, this goes back to clients and consulting. I like to be able to sit down if I'm pair programming with someone and have them recognize my environment. I've just learned to be productive in the default environment. And I may modify things here and there, but for the most part, it's pretty simple. I don't change it much.
Oh, that makes sense. You're in a position where at many times you're sort of trying to explain or teach people how to code with Android Studio and stuff. So in that case, it makes sense to use the default thing, because then it makes it immediately recognizable.
Yeah, and it's also when you're giving presentations to user groups at conferences and so forth, you want to have a familiar environment. For me, I want to be able to present in a familiar environment to the people that are coming to my session, so they're not confused of like, whoa, what is that crazy thing you're using right there? Now, if they sometimes that still happens, like, hey, I just hit this crazy keyboard shortcut, and they're like, everyone's like, whoa, what did you just do? Mm-hmm. Then I'll tell them that. But for the most part, I like just to keep it simple for a lot of those reasons.
Right. So to give you an idea of the extent that I went to customize this thing, there's actually a very nice theme. It's called the Base 16 theme, and this is by Chris Kempson. We'll add a link to the show notes. Now, the funny thing is there isn't an IntelliJ Base 16 theme. So what I actually did was I changed that theme.
What is the Base 16 theme? Is that just a theme name, or what is it?
So it basically is like a theme name. So what this person, Chris Kempson, did is over the years, he's been tweaking his theme like in all sorts of editors. So like even in the terminal, in TextMate, in iTerm, in all these sort of different applications and environments, he's been tweaking his theme a little, and come out with this like really amazing set of themes. There are variants to this theme. Base 16 is actually, it's sort of like a superset of the themes, and there are small variants within it. So I use the Ocean variant of this Base 16 theme. What I did was I actually sort of used the theme from TextMate, I believe. I changed the TextMate theme to an IntelliJ sort of variant, and I actually use that IntelliJ variant now. So I went through a lot of trouble to make sure that that theme was available to me.
Went through a lot of trouble to make sure that the Rails followed you through.
One more thing. I have my environment actually on GitHub. So for people who are interested and don't want to go through the same trouble of sort of converting this whole thing, I'll add a link to that as well in the show notes. So you can get a hold of this theme if you're interested.
Excellent. So for me, I just use the basic Darkula theme. I like the dark screen. Mainly because a lot of times I'll be working at night on the couch next to the wife when she's watching a show or something like that, and I don't want to be getting a tan from my computer screen. So I'll use Darkula, and then what I normally do also is I tend to bump up the font size actually, and the reason for that is because I try not to squint. I've been developing upwards of 15 years now. And earlier in my career, I noticed I would try to fit more text in the screen. So I'd bump the font size down. And then I started having a weird side effect where I would go home at night and then my eyes would like literally rattle back and forth in my head. It was the craziest, weirdest thing. And I went to went to a doctor and I'm like, yeah, you're stressing your eyes out. And so I just bumped up the font size. I had read a blog post by someone else saying it helped them. And that's what I did. I just bumped up the font size a couple sizes, and it's fine. I don't wear glasses. I can see perfectly fine. It happened to do it for me.
So we talked about the theme and the color. Now, there's also this thing called code styles in IntelliJ. What code style does is it allows you to format your code in a very specific fashion. So I use this option a lot, is when you have your XML layouts in Android, I like having my XML layouts laid out in like a specific fashion. So for example, if you have your ID, you have your name tag, you have your height, you have your width, you can actually ask the IDE to format it in a very specific fashion. So I can hit a shortcut, reformat the code, and it'll always follow the same order that I have. So if you have like 10 or 20 views in there, when I'm actually typing the code, I know I need to add like a wrap content. I need to add like a match parent on my layout height or my width. So I go ahead and just like add those in as I think about them. Then I hit one keyboard shortcut and boom, the whole thing is formatted in a very specific fashion.
What's that keyboard shortcut that you use?
So this is another problem. I moved from Sublime Text. So another thing that I did is I actually changed all of the keyboard shortcuts to sort of like reflect what it is in Sublime Text. I believe it's reformat code. That's what it's called. Let me pull up Android Studio and make sure that's what it is.
Yeah, I think it's Alt Command L, I think it is, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I haven't changed that one. Yeah, so Command Alt L is basically what I use, and it's called reformat code. Mm-hmm. Usually what happens is it'll pop up a dialog saying, hey, do you want to reformat the code and actually change the order of lines and something like that. So I have that dialog by default to the preferences I want. So I just hit Command Alt L and boom, the whole thing just gets ordered.
Yeah, I think that's a very useful thing. And I think it's also one huge point of contention for a lot of teams. So there's a lot of huge debate about, you know, tab sizes and where your brackets should go and so forth. It ends up being people get very, very passionate about it. I tend, as a consultant, I'll come in, and if a team has a particular way they like to format their code, then so be it. And what I've found is these code styles, you can create different ones and save them and basically import them later, is it makes it a lot easier for me, because I know MyFitnessPal, for example, they like the top level bracket of each class or method or if statement or so forth to be on a new line, while the traditional method is to keep that top level bracket on the same line as the initial definition of the class or method or so forth. So it can be very useful for a variety of reasons. And then it's easy to know that, hey, all right, I'm going to type my code the way I'm used to writing it. And then when I'm done, I can hit Command Alt L. And then another nice thing is if you use the built-in version control inside of Android Studio will integrate with Subversion, Git, and so forth. You can actually, if you commit your code through there, you can actually have it reformat your code prior to commit as well. So you don't, if you forget to do it and you just do all your work in there, it can just handle it for you as well.
Another really nice feature that Android Studio has is live templates. And I guess each person has different templates. It comes with a standard set, but I've added like a bunch of live templates that I find are pretty useful. Now, if you're coming from another IDE, I'm not sure what they call this feature specifically, but it's essentially inserting code snippets. But it's a little more intelligent than just sort of pasting snippets, because what you can do is you can insert a snippet and then you can say that, hey, after this snippet is inserted, I want my cursor to be at a particular position. And after you declare a class, then it can automatically suggest a sort of variable name depending on like your preferences. For example, one preference that I have is I usually like to have my private variables with the prefix of an underscore. So if I actually start typing a variable out, it'll automatically give me a suggestion for a variable name with the underscore. So it's just small niceties that you have with live templates.
Yeah, I use a couple for myself as well. I use for the live templates, I did this all the way back with ReSharper back in the day. And one that I always found that I use all the time, still to this day for at least over 10 years now, is I create a live template called ATH, and that's for assert that. So if you use the assert J library for testing, you'll find that you are always typing assert that and then a value dot is equal to the expectation. You'll find you continually do that over and over and over. And so what I've done is created just a couple of live templates. So ATH for assert that and EQT for equal to seem to be the ones that I'm using all the time, and speeds it up over and over. And it may seem like, okay, big deal, Don, you're saving 6 or 7 keystrokes at a time. But when you start thinking about this in a really the bigger picture, this also happens when I used to use Windows as well. I used to open up the Notepad application, and you would open up, you know, Command or Windows Run at the time, and then you type Notepad and Enter. Well, I changed it to just the letter N. And so I'd hit N. And so it saved keystrokes, but over a day, maybe it would save me a couple of minutes because I would save a couple of seconds here and there throughout the day. So I'd save a minute or two. But over the course of a few weeks or a month, I mean, you're saving, you know, upwards of an hour just because you're not typing a few keystrokes if you're doing it that much. So I hyper focus on saving as much time as I possibly can, and the keystrokes and live templates help that.
That makes sense. This again reminds me of something that Ben Orenstein used to say. So he basically, what he did in the terminal was he had a command that would basically give him, like, it would show him his history. So when you use the terminal, you can basically see all the commands that you've used. So he had actually like a command which would tell him like the most frequently used commands that he had. And one thing that he noticed that he was using a lot was git status, like basically to check the status of your repository. And so what he did is he basically put an alias for that. So if you type G, then it immediately gives you like the git status. And I know many people have like aliases like that. So it brings up a point. If you frequently keep typing the same command over and over again, it makes sense to have like a shortcut because, hey, we're programmers and many of us do have RSI problems as well, right?
Exactly.
I have two live templates and I call these T3 and T4. And that's basically if I want to write a JUnit 3 test, like with the whole sort of assert that I have like conditions where it says assert that X when Y so that Z. So I have that whole thing inserted right away when I put T3 in a JUnit 3 format. And if I'm in a JUnit 4 test, then basically I have T4, which it adds the annotation on top, which has like the at test annotation. In JUnit 3, you don't have, you can't use like the test annotations, but what if I believe the convention is if it starts with the word test, then it's considered to be a test.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think we've touched upon this, but I guess now it makes sense to talk about some of our sort of favorite keyboard shortcuts.
Yeah, so you can customize shortcuts inside of Android Studio. You can use the ones that are built in. Now, you're going to want to know what your default key map is, and a key map inside of Android Studio is the key combinations that are set up for that particular environment. And so there's different key maps that you can use. So for example, there's OS X 5 Plus, mm-hmm. there's OS X, there's one like Eclipse style, there's ones like ReSharper, there's a whole bunch of other ones, and you can create your own key maps and you can search by name. And this is inside of the preferences, so you can go into the menu and know preferences, and then inside the little filter there, just type key map, or you can look inside the list. And then you can choose the one that you like. I prefer the default one, which I think is the OS X 5 Plus, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, I am using the Mac OS X 10.5 Plus. I have taken that and I've copied it and created my own custom keyboard shortcuts that I'll show you here as well. Now, keyboard shortcuts in itself, we could probably do an entire list of episodes on it. But below, oh, yeah. We're going to go ahead and we're going to talk about some of our favorite and preferred ones here. Mm-hmm. So Kaushik, do you want to share some of the ones that you like to use?
Yeah, sure. So one thing, and I guess this falls in both of our lists, is this thing called Find Actions. Now, I believe this started either with TextMate or Sublime Text, where you could pull up like a window and you could essentially search for anything in your IDE. So even if there's a command that you don't exactly remember what the keyboard shortcut is for, there's this dialog called Find Action. Now, I actually have it linked to Command Shift P, which I'm pretty sure is not the default at all. But if you look in the key maps that Don was mentioning, Find Action is what it's called. So that's probably one of the most useful keyboard shortcuts that I use. I have Find Action, and even if there's something that I believe that should be a shortcut for, but I don't remember the shortcut for it specifically, then invariably I'll find it there. So that's a very useful keyboard shortcut.
The default for that, if you're using the 5 Plus version, which is the default that comes with Android Studio, it's Command Shift A.
Along the same lines, there's also one called Search Everywhere, and this is a little different from Finding Actions. What this does is it essentially searches for any kind of file that you have. So if it's an XML file, if it's a Gradle script, if it's a class file, if it's anything, basically, if you have a file inside your project, then search everywhere, looks for it completely. Now, I said Command Shift P was my find action. I have this search everywhere keyboard shortcut linked to Command P. What is the default for this, Don?
The default for search everywhere is actually just shift. So you're going to double tap the shift key, and then it will bring up the search everywhere. So just double tap shift key.
It's
the default. Some of the ones that I have a whole list of ones that I use here. I actually did a screencast on some of the nice ones that I've used, and that's a screencast is it's a year and a half old now, but it's still viewed quite a bit, and it'll be in the show notes. You can check it out, and I show exactly what the keyboard shortcuts I use are. But the ones that I have here, I have a little list here. I'll kind of run through them. So I use Find Action as well, and that's Command Shift A. That's where you can open the Find Action window, open something up, and if you know that you want to rename a variable and you don't know what that key combination is, you can just open the Find Action window and just type rename, and it will show you what the rename key combination is. So very useful. The next one is Alt Enter. Alt Enter is probably the most used keyboard shortcut in my arsenal, and I use Alt Enter. Alt Enter can be used anytime you see the little light bulb pop up, and this is going to be a red light bulb or a yellow light bulb. You'll see that inside of the editor. Perhaps when you type something, like you need a field. You're in a method. You know you need a field. You type that first name field equals, something service.getFirstName. But you need it as a field, and it's going to turn red because it doesn't exist. The IDE recognizes it. You can put your cursor on it, hit Alt Enter. It'll provide you with a context-sensitive options of what you can do. It said, would you like to create a variable? Would you like to create a field? Would you like to create a constant? Would you like to create whatever? And so I use this all over the place. The same thing works for also if I'm going to be using a class. Maybe I have a little helper method that's going to do something. So I have a view utils class, which has a bunch of utility methods for working with views. I'll type view utils dot, and then it will be red because I haven't performed the import yet. I can put my cursor on it, Alt Enter, and it'll say, would you like to import this? Yes. So anytime you see anything that's red inside of your application, or maybe even squiggly under it or something like that, put your cursor on it, hit Alt Enter. You're going to get context sensitive options of what you can do. Very useful.
So this keyboard shortcut, Alt Enter, is basically linked to show intention actions. That's what it's called in the key map.
Okay. Yeah, I had no idea what the name of it was.
Yeah. I mean, half these things are just muscle memory. I mean, I use these shortcuts. I have no idea what they're called. So the key map is really helpful because you can actually search with the shortcuts. If you enter the keys, then it tells you exactly what those are.
If the shortcuts aren't working for you for Kaushik's one, try the find action and then look for, what we may be saying, go to definition or whatever we're talking about, and then you can find it in there. All the ones that I'll be talking about are from the default OS X 10.5 Plus. Did you mind if I hop into a couple more of them?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So another one that I use all the time is Command Shift Backspace. This is very useful. It takes you to the last edited location. This is really useful because anytime you have multiple files opening, you find yourself going down the rabbit hole of trying to find what the code is doing. And before you know it, you're 10 files deep. You have no idea where you were at before. You don't remember what file you're in because you've just been doing it for 5 or 10 minutes. And the best way to do that is hit Command Shift Backspace, and what that will do is take you to the last edited location. You can hit it again and it will take you to the previously edited location before that one, and so you can kind of traverse up the tree to where you want to be. So if you've edited a couple of times or a couple little files, you'll get back to where you were before. It makes navigation a lot easier.
That's a really useful one.
Another one that I use is Alt plus F7. This is find usages. And so I will select maybe a interface or a class, and I want to know where it's used at. Or a lot of times, if you're using something like auto for an event bus, you want to know where an event is being used. And I will then highlight or put my cursor on the class name and then hit Alt F7, and it will show me all the usages. Another one that I use all the time is Command B. Now this is go to implementation. And so if you have a variable inside of your class anywhere, and you're in line 400 and you want to know where this variable was defined at in a huge method or in a huge class, you put your cursor on it, hit Command B. That will take you to where the variable was defined at. And this could be a variable, a constant, could be anything. So if you're using a constant inside of your application, you can hit Command B. It'll take you to the implementation. It'll also take you inside of a linked library that you have. So if you're pulling in a library like Picasso or something like that, and you want to know where Picasso.withContext method is going or where it's defined, you want to look at the implementation if the source is available, you hit Command B, it will take you to that location. Another one that I like to use a lot is Command Option B. If I have an abstract class or I have an interface and I want to know who is implementing that, I can just put my cursor on the class name or on the interface name, hit Command Option B. It will show you the list of implementations. If there's only one implementation, it will take you directly to that implementation at that time. Another one I use is Command U. That will take you to the superclass. So if you have an implementation that we were just talking about, you're looking at the implementation, you can hit Command U. It'll take you to the superclass.
Oh, Command U is really useful, especially with Java, because you have interfaces, you have abstract classes, and you basically want to see the superclass implementation. Command U is very useful.
Exactly. And one that recently came up that I was having a huge problem with that Jake Wharton actually showed me was scroll to source. This is the little icon if you're looking in the project structure. It kind of looks like a little target that you would see through like a scope of a rifle or something. If you're working in a file and you have 300 files in your project and you don't know where this file is at inside of your project, or you don't want to go open 20 folders to get to it, you can just hit the scroll to source button and it'll take you directly to where the file is at and highlight it for you. Now, this is a problem if you don't like using your mouse like me and you just want to go directly to there. And what you can do is hit Alt, then F1, and then Enter. And so Alt F1 opens the Select Target window, and you can select if it's going to be Commander, Navigation Bar, or Project View. Number one is Project View. It's highlighted by default, so you hit Enter, and it takes you right to the file's location in the Project View. And I'll cover a couple more here, and I'll be done here. One of my use a lot is sometimes I'll have many panels open. If I'm looking at the Logcat panel, I'll maybe have my cursor in there playing around looking for something. But I want to close it easily. You can close any panel that you're currently in using Shift and Escape. It'll close the panel. Another one that's really useful is if you have, again, those 20 files that are open, you're going back and forth between files. You can either use Control Tab as the switcher. That opens a switcher window, and you can actually tab through your files using Control Tab, so you don't have to use the mouse to click between tabs. But then also, if you don't want to do that, you want to go back and forth between two files or three files pretty quickly, you can use Alt Left and Alt Right. And it's just like the browser. It'll take you back and forth to your previous locations inside of your file. So it's really fast to navigate around using those key commands.
Do you want to talk about any of the other ones that we have?
Yeah, we have you can also do use the tools prefix. So there's a link we're going to add that shows how you can use the tools namespace, so you can actually show dummy text. So a lot of times when you're building Android views, you'll put some text inside the view so it looks like when you're building it inside the preview. But what happens is you forget to take that text out, and then you ship with it, and all of a sudden there's some dummy text, some lorem ipsum text inside of your application at runtime and production. Oops. So there's other ways you can get around that, either for previews. You can use the tools namespace. So you can use tools colon text, and then you could use text that will show up in the tools environment as the preview. You can also do it, for example, if you have fragments inside of your layout that you've put in there, you can preview the layout for the fragment. So the rendering engine knows that there's a fragment there, and you say, hey, when you render it, you know there's a fragment, but here's the layout that I want you to show in the preview. And so it's very nice to preview the layouts.
Yeah. One place I've also found this particularly useful is sometimes I have relative layouts, and because the requirement is pretty specific, I actually have to programmatically sort of like position certain layouts. I found that when I'm actually developing, throwing in that tools prefix and giving an approximate sort of location gives me a better idea. So when I actually open up the XML layout, I know I have a decent understanding as to where each position is. So the tools prefix is extremely useful in those sort of locations. Like sometimes I just add a color. I add like a tools. I add the tools prefix along with the color, and then it gives me an idea of how like things would look.
We were talking earlier about some other cool stuff in Android Studio before we hopped on the show, and one of those was some of the annotation magic, as you had called it. It'd be really cool if you could talk about a little bit of that. I'm familiar with some of the annotation stuff, but I did learn a little bit about the contract annotations. I think listeners would probably be really interested in some of that information.
Oh, sure. So typically when you use annotations in Java, there are many uses for annotations, but what we're talking about is specifically support annotations. The folks over at Google, the tools team, they basically came out with this thing called Android support annotations. Now we'll add a link to the show notes to the official sort of page. There's also someone who's written up a blog post specifically for Android development where they give some of the useful support annotations. So definitely have a look at that. Here's a common use case. You have a method that you know possibly could return a null, or you have a method that doesn't return a null. The lint tool can actually be pretty helpful when you're coding. So if for some reason you realize that you're running code that could cause a null pointer exception, I mean, null pointer exceptions are very, very common to a Java developer and more so to an Android developer. I remember in one of the screencasts that you released, Don, you actually say, always expect a null pointer exception. Always keep checking for null. So, so this really helps with that because the lint immediately sort of jumps out at you and it tells you, hey, you could possibly have a null pointer exception here. Now, the way this would work is only if you have your methods annotated with this specific annotation. And I believe the two annotations that are pretty useful in this context are, I believe it's at nullable. That's one very useful annotation. So if you have the at nullable annotation, then it basically says that, hey, there is a chance that this method could return a null. So at nullable is a very useful annotation. And what the tools team actually has done is, like, whenever you use any of the support library methods, they actually have gone through all of the support library and actually added these helpful annotations here and there. The lint checks are very useful in sort of helping you identify potential null pointer exceptions. Also, another common use case is if you're using resources, for example, you have a string resource file, you have your color resources file, you have like your dimension resource files. Now, when you're working with code, all these resource references are actually integers. So you could potentially pass any integer value and your application wouldn't throw a compile time error. You would know of this error only on runtime. So what you can do is you can sort of annotate method parameters and say, hey, this, I'm expecting a string resource here, or I'm expecting a dimension resource. And the lint would automatically warn you when you actually give it a reference that isn't a string resource or a dimension resource. So this is pretty useful as well. These are Android support annotations. One thing that I also recently came to know of, and this is, again, hat tip to the amazing Jake Wharton for letting me know of this. IntelliJ has this thing called contract annotations. Now, I talked about null. Typically, what I do is, for those who have used Java, there's this method that basically automatically checks if a string is null or it's empty. Usually, when you use a string, you don't only check if the string is null, you also want to check that it's not empty. So Java actually has this helper utility method. I have a bunch of these as well that I've written sort of as an internal library. I check if a list is empty. I check if the object that I have is empty. If I pass in three objects, then I basically have a helper method that says, hey, give me the first non-null out of all of these things. What I've noticed is with these internal methods that I have in my utility library, the lint doesn't recognize those. I asked people around, hey, is there a mechanism for the lint to be able to sort of understand that this method will never return a null or this method will always return a null? Having those utility methods annotated with the right annotation makes it super useful because then I don't get those faulty lint errors that say, hey, you could potentially have a null pointer if I've already checked that that variable is not null. So I'll add a link to the contract annotations page. The annotations are slightly cryptic. They have these contract rules, and when I looked at them, they weren't immediately obvious. But if you look at the page and look at some of the examples there, then it becomes pretty useful. One of the advantages with Java in general, I mean, say what you might, like, I know people like to poo-poo a lot on the Java programming language, but yeah. One of the biggest advantages that you have is the compile time safety with Java, right? If you try to pass in a string when it's expecting an integer, it will throw up an error right at compile time. And this can be super useful. What these annotations sort of allow you to do is sort of, even to an extent, catch potential runtime exceptions at compile time. So it sort of like removes a bunch of potential bugs and errors.
I agree. All right, let's go ahead and kind of wrap this up. I think before we get going, we'd like to share some awesome things that we've found during the week. My list is kind of short, so I'll just kind of hop into it real quick. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of things that I want to share with everyone. One is Stetho. Stetho is a library that was released by Facebook. Now, it's a debugging platform for Android, basically. To be completely honest, is a lot of times from stuff from Facebook, they're on such a high, huge scale that it doesn't apply to the most developers out there. And I think that's a lot of the times I won't pay attention to a lot of the things they release because I'll look at it and be like, okay, that's well beyond what I need to worry about right now or my clients need to worry about. Stato, on the other hand, is something that's so useful that I am just eternally grateful for at this point in time. And so what Stato does is you just basically wire it up in your application and it provides you with a bunch of debugging tools through Chrome. And so what this means is you have your emulator, your device running, you install Stato, and then what happens is you can then tell Stato to dump out the results to its default listener. And that listener is actually Chrome's developer tools. So if you've worked inside of a web environment, you've been inside the Chrome developer tools, you've looked at the CSS and the JavaScript, and you've been in there debugging, and you can see the network times and so forth. And so what this does is it actually shoves all of that debug information into that panel. So you can actually see your network requests. You can see if anything's failing. You can see how long things are taking, each one of these images, or maybe your network requests are taking all the way across the line. Another thing is you can go into the resources tab inside of the Chrome DevTools, and that will show you the basic SQL, you know, web SQL and all that kind of stuff. Well, if you open the web SQL and you have a content provider, a database or something, it will show you your database and you can inspect your database right there through the browser that's on your device. This is insanely useful. As soon as we installed it, we found two issues already that we had with our application. One of our API calls had a typo in it, and we were getting a 304 or something like that as a redirect because we were hitting the wrong endpoint, and our app was just on a weird edge case, and we just happened to be watching the network panel. So very useful. Check out Stato. It's in the show notes. And then the other thing that I'd like to share is I'm consistently doing more and more RxJava, and I'm finding that I need to educate people on how to get into RxJava. It's a humongous, tremendous learning curve. Once you kind of grok it, it's kind of like the first time you really got Git. You understood. You understand branching. You understand the commands, and then it just clicked for you. You just thought, like, oh my gosh, like this is unbelievable. That's what RxJava is. It's kind of like Git. The first time you get it, it just slaps you in the face, and you can't live without it anymore. And learning it can be troublesome. So I wanted to share the link that Daniel Liu had written. He wrote a small four-part or five-part series on RxJava. It's a great little series to just kind of get your feet wet, understand what observers, observables are, how you can transform things and so forth. So definitely check that out if you have time.
Oh, that's a fantastic series. I've worked a little with RxJava as well. And Dan's series is just amazing, especially for people who want to like quickly sort of like understand what the heck RxJava is or like warm up to it. That series is an amazing series.
You've worked a little more than a little bit with it. You've written some of the better blog posts on RxJava, so you can't fool anybody. You have some great stuff out there that I even bumped into before I knew you and I was looking at. So good job on that.
Thanks, Dan. So for my awesome pick, I only have one pick, but I think this is pretty amazing. So I was listening to some online chatter, and a person asked what typically is the mechanism that people use for rounded image views. So my awesome pick for this week is rounded image views. Now, traditionally, if you try to search online, the most common way that people do is they have like a custom image view or they have like a custom drawable, and they use a bitmap shader, and it's a little more complicated than it actually needs to be. And hat tip to the amazing Chris Baines. So for those who don't know who Chris Baines is, he's the person who most recently is heading the app compat sort of movement. Amazing developer. You should follow him on Google+ as well.
Baines's top tip.
So he basically pointed out the existence of this thing called a rounded bitmap drawable. Now, I was amazed at how simple, and it's almost laughably easy. If you want an image view now, if you use the rounded bitmap drawable, it's completely insane how easy it is to get rounded image views. Typically, people use this for if you have like a social application or you want to display the profile picture of someone in a rounded image view. If you use a rounded bitmap drawable, it is super simple. I whipped up a quick gist on GitHub. I've put a link to that as well in the show notes. With two lines of code, you can basically get a beautiful rounded image view. I would, however, also suggest that people go back and see traditionally how this is done. There's a blog post by Evilio Carceres. So he has a blog post, and I'll put a link to that as well, where he talks about the different mechanisms that people have been using to get rounded image views. So that has been like my go-to post to sort of really understand how these things work. Definitely have a look at that blog post because it gives you a very good understanding. And as an Android developer, if you want to understand some of the APIs even better, it helps you get a good grip on that. But after having gone through that, now you see how easy it is to use the rounded bitmap drawable. It changed my life. I was like, oh my God, where has this solution been all my life? It's so simple. So that's my pick for the week.
It's kind of like when you're in high school and you learn how to do math the long way, and then they're like, yeah, like, hey, all of a sudden, here's the simple way to do it. It's two steps. And you're like, why didn't you show me that in the first place?
Yeah. The learning is important. The journey is pretty important. So
Exactly. There's a method to the madness, but anyway. So all right, it's time to wrap up this episode. You can find the show notes for this episode at fragmentedpodcast.com/episodes/2. Again, that's fragmentedpodcast.com/episodes/2. In the show notes, you'll find links to the things we talk about during the show. Links to our picks will also be found here in the show notes. If you have any feedback or suggestions for the episode, go ahead and send us a tweet. We eagerly look forward to your feedback on making the show better. And if you have any suggestions for future shows or interviews, please let us know as well. If you want to reach out to one of us, you can reach me, Don Felker, at Twitter at Don Felker. That's DonFelker. Or you can hit my blog at donfelker.com.
And if you want to reach me, you can reach me at my Twitter handle, which is Kaushik Gopal. That's KaushikGopal. And my website is kaush.co, so kaush.co. So you can get hold of most of the stuff that I do at that site.
Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in our next episode.
See ya.